tonight on Arena. Max Porter on his new novel, Shy, and Andrew Leggy on his new film, Lola. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. A new Irish-British film co-production, Lola, is the story of two sisters, Thomasina and Martha Hanbury, who live in England during the years of the Second World War. Thomasina has invented a machine called Lola that can intercept radio and TV broadcasts from the future. Might be listening to us right now. So while the two girls live in a rural idyll, they are entertained by David Bowie and other visitors from the future. But when the Germans begin to bomb Britain, the sisters use Lola to warn citizens against impending attacks. The film is a science fiction meets historic drama meets found footage cinema. And it was filmed on location in Ireland with many Irish cast and crew members. But the writer and director, Andrew Legg, beg your pardon for giving you an extra E at the beginning there, Andrew, is with me in studio this evening. This Lola machine, it's a wonderful conceit, really, really strong idea. Just explain the idea behind it, first of all, and where did you come up with the idea of this superluminal communicator?
Gosh, it's a good question. So I think I'd done a load of short films, which were all about kind of madcap, eccentric inventors making different things. And I wanted to do a movie. I obviously wanted to go from shorts into features, and I wanted to do a film where I was leaning into what I'd already done. And I'd made a little short film called The Chronoscope years ago, which was about a scientist who could see into the past. And we liked the idea of kind of expanding that into a feature film. The Chronoscope was a much more traditional kind of faux documentary like Zelig with talking heads. So Kevin Brownlow was in it, and Kevin Myers was in it, and Pat McCabe were in it, like playing themselves. And then we had like kind of archival footage. So it was like a traditional documentary. So we kind of expanded that idea into a feature. And then we changed things like the machine could see into the future because it gives you a lot more plot possibilities than seeing into the past. And
how quickly did, because seeing into the future, of course, is it's a sci-fi kind of stalwart of the tropes of sci-fi quite often. How quickly did you decide that setting the present moment of the film, if you like, in World War II and in World War II Britain, when did that aspect of the story start to make its way in for you?
I think kind of early on, like, because I'm kind of a history geek anyway. Like, I love, like, kind of 20th century history. So I love the idea of kind of playing with that. And I've always been into kind of archive. And I love doing period stuff. Because maybe out of nostalgia, because the past is just so, everything's just so beautiful, like the clothes and everything. And it just, I think the 1940s was interesting. I liked the idea of these two women who were kind of brought up as Edwardian women. Being a little bit feral in this house, but being exposed to media from the future. So like these two feral women listening to David Bowie and listening to the Kinks and stuff. I just thought it was really fun because they're in an age before we've had all this kind of culture that, you know, like it's a totally different era. So that kind of juxtaposition. So I think that was all quite early that we did that.
Yeah, and I guess you say that you're a fan of history. Are you a fan of alternative histories, which is essentially what we get here, because the two sisters realizing that they can see events that will happen in wartime, that's vital because they can then predict where there might be German attacks, etc., etc., and create an alternative history where possibly people don't die.
Yeah, so the alternate history wouldn't be huge. No, not really. Like, I mean, I suppose I'm interested, like there are interesting what ifs of history and of the Second World War. Like if the Americans hadn't come into the Second World War, it would have been dramatically different. Yeah. Or if Hitler hadn't invaded the Soviet Union, it would have been, he probably would have won the war if those two things had gone the other way. So I suppose there's little hinges or little turning points in history that are quite interesting, and it's quite interesting to play with.
Yeah, if things panned out differently, how would the overall story be? Let's have a listen to a clip from early in the film, and this is Stephanie Martini here as Martha recalling the invention of the machine Lola, the invention by Thomasina, played by Emma Appleton, and some very interesting music that they came across when they looked into the future.
I'll never forget that day we switched her on for the first time. 1st of October, 1938.
We've seen the future.
Lola opened a magical new world. 1938 went into 1939, but those dates meant nothing to us. We were living in another time.
They certainly were living in another time. The voice of Stephanie Martina there as Martini, rather, as Martha in the film Lola, and Andrew Legg, writer and director of the film, is with me now. I presume you're a Bowie fan. What sent you that was one of the musics from the future that the sisters would come across?
It's just music I like. Like, I would be a Bowie fan, but also I wanted to music that was kind of iconic, and also that was like otherworldly to like 1940s women. Somebody said it recently. Like, he's like a film reviewer recently described him as being like this kind of angel of glam rock coming out of the ether. I think it's just so iconic, David Bowie.
Yeah, and I suppose in some ways, if you were going to have somebody visit you from the future, Bowie is the kind of perfect musician for that, because he has that kind of otherworldly feel to him, as you say.
Exactly.
When I know there's a line at one point along the film, Thomasina is sometimes, her name is shortened to Tom, and Major Tom, of course, is the famous Bowie, from the famous Bowie song. That is in the script. You were telling me just as we were listening that was a total accident.
Yeah, so the film, the characters were called Thomasina and Martha, or Tom and Mars, way earlier. Well, actually, they were just Thomasina and Martha, and then we liked the idea of little like nicknames for each other, like Tom and Mars. A total coincidence. I think she was called Thomasina because it's just such, I love the name, probably from Beatrix Potter or something. Like, there's a cat called Thomasina. So it's just a coincidence. And then I wasn't even aware of the coincidence until Emma said it to me when we were shooting the film. She said, "I presume that was intentional." I was like, no.
And Mars is the short name for Martha at times as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a coincidence.
Pure coincidence in that respect. What does happen as the film begins to progress then, Andrew, is we see that they can intercept tomorrow's radio communications to find out what is happening in terms of the war in 1941, and that means that they can prevent attacks from happening. They can predict where attacks will come so that the army can be prepared for them, etc. But it that has its own set of difficulties, of course.
Yes. So I guess the it's the paradox thing, isn't it? Where if you see the future, you change it, and whether deliberately they're deliberately changing the future, they're trying to avoid things, but then there's the kind of inadvertent consequences of that as well.
Well, one of the inadvertent consequences, and I'm not giving anything away here, is that potentially there could be no David Bowie if the girls' alternative history did take place. Those type of things, you must have had fun with what you would get rid of in the future.
Yeah, so the two women, they kind of go out of control in that Tom gets more and more into manipulating the future with her machine, and then Mars goes off singing Kink songs in London nightclubs and making Kink songs like hits before their time, and that has unforeseeable consequences for the time stream.
Yeah, well, let's have a listen to her. Stephanie Martini doing a very good job on the Kinks, it has to be said. Let's have a listen to her in action in that respect.
Tom, that's it. Thank you.
that's what the Kinks would have sounded like had it been around in 1941. That's from the film Lola. And Andrew Legg, the writer and director, is with me in studio this evening. I was saying one of the things I loved is that it becomes a big slogan even for the war. You really got me going. And that it's a real motivator for wartime. And it becomes a big dance in the film as well. A big popular dance, which of course didn't happen because we're in the world of science fiction here. But the music was very interesting there because it starts on piano and then it moves into a kind of a period style, the big swing band that's playing alongside them there. Who did the music here?
So Neil Hannon was their composer for the film, and then he worked with Keane Boylan. So that's Keane Boylan and his swing band who were doing that. So it's a 10-piece swing band making the thing. They arranged it. They rearranged the Kinks.
And it sounds great for her. And the dance that they do alongside it as well is kind of somehow manages to cross both periods as well. It looks like something that could have happened in the 1940s, but yet it's perfect for the music of the 20th century. The other thing that I thought was interesting, you might talk a little bit about it, Andrew, was there were times when I was looking at wartime scenes. The film is shot in black and white. And then you have archive news footage, some of which looks very real, and yet there are aspects that it can't be real because there are things in the film, from the film specifically, from the story that you're telling, that fit into this news archive. How did you go about manipulating those original archive films?
So that was a bit of a head wreck. So what we did was we had the script, and then we'd have like a scene in the script, which would be like our ideal scene of what was meant to happen. So to give you an example, there's a scene where the sisters, which isn't giving away much, where the sisters get arrested kind of halfway through the film, and they're taken to a courthouse. And so in the script, that was like sisters are taken to a courthouse through an angry mob. And so I went through the archive looking for angry mobs. Like you go onto AP and you kind of type in your keywords like angry mob outside London courthouse. And we couldn't really find anything in that. But I came across this footage of a strike, and they had a balloon at the strike, and the balloon had a slogan on it. And they're kind of pushing the balloon around. And then the police kind of grab the balloon, and then you see the protesters kind of trying to get the balloon back. But what we did was we rewrote the script then so that the angry mob had a balloon with a slogan denouncing the sisters written on it.
Yeah.
And then I reverse engineered it. So then we went and found locations in Dublin that looked like the location in the footage, which was the King's Inns, the archway at the King's Inns.
Wow.
And then we tried to kind of match, because obviously we're cutting two shots to get it like 80 years apart, one in Dublin, one in London. So we kind of did a wet down, and because the footage, it's wet. And then our third year, Murphy, like our prop, our production designer made the balloon, matching the balloon in the.
So it really is. It really was manipulating and playing around with that archive footage and mixing it with what you shot in contemporary times. And it looks incredibly real, I have to say. I mean, there's a bombing of the Parliament, the Houses of Parliament in Britain, which obviously didn't happen, and yet it looks very real. Again, you mixed some contemporary stuff with archive materials. So that's how you did it.
Yeah, it's like augmenting archive. The other thing that really helped with the movie was we shot everything on film, so it was all shot on 16mm and 35mm. And we used period cameras, so all the footage that Marza is shooting in the house of her sister, like she's documenting, was shot on a Bolex, 16mm Bolex.
That gave us a sense of the period, even in the way it was shot.
Exactly, because you've got these really old lenses. You're using black and white film. Film stocks haven't really changed very much since the 1940s. So the stuff, and then the Bolex is wind up, so you get this kind of variation and little crackles and like variations in exposure. The lenses are like
slightly
really
different.
Old. Yeah. So the stuff actually came out of the camera looking quite authentic already.
For the period.
Yeah,
of time.
We didn't have to do a lot of manipulation.
Yeah, well, listen, it makes for fascinating and very entertaining viewing, that's for sure. Now, you've done the past in Chronoscope, you've done the future now in Lola. You're going to do a film set in the present at any point?
Next film I want to do in the 1970s.
Yeah, all right.
And I want to do it in colour. I'm not doing another black. I mean, we love black and white, but I think colour. I think we should do something.
You're going for colour. Going to come in. You come into the real 20th century then, in the 1970s. Thanks for coming into us this evening, Andrew. That's Andrew Legg. And Lola, Andrew's film, opens in cinemas on April the 7th, and we will be reviewing it on tomorrow night's programme. The first time I spoke with author Max Porter was back in 2019 when his second novel, Lanny, was published. It tells the story of a boy growing up in a rural village in England. A mystical novel featured the lurking presence of an ancient spirit who haunts the village, a spirit called Dead Papa Toothwort. Of course, Max's first novel, Grief is the Thing with Feathers, also tells the story of a young boy, in that case a young boy coming to terms with the loss of his mother. His new novel is called Shy, and once again we have a young boy, possibly adolescent really, here at the centre of the narrative. This time round, mysticism is replaced with visceral real-world concerns. The central character, called Shy, is a violent teenager boy on retreat in a farmhouse in the country. Delighted to have Max Porter with us now. Is there a sense, I know it's not realism in the gritty realism sense the way you present it to us, Max, but is there a sense in which you are bringing us into a much more realistic or authentic world? Authentic isn't the right word, but a more realistic world in terms of the story of Shy?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I mean, I haven't left mysticism behind completely. I don't think I ever can. We don't want to give any spoilers, but things occur to the poor boy that are maybe not of this world. But yeah, I think in its primary concerns, it's a book about society and education and the behaviour of, as you say, delinquent, unhappy teenagers. And that feels more of the social realist world, certainly. Perhaps not in style, but in substance, definitely.
Yes, yeah, it certainly is. The style is still your hallmark. You've kind of post a modernist type of approach where you could take in fragments from all over the place and different voices coming in as well, which is part of Shai's condition, in fact, which allows you to tell us the story in that way, in that he is hearing voices a lot of the time in his own head. What is the nature of those voices?
Well, they're a sort of bombardment. They're like his weather system. There's a therapist, there's his stepdad, there's his mother, there's his peers, there's the bullying and cajoling and violent language of his fellow, I won't say inmates, but it's close to that, his fellow students at this progressive educational establishment. And it came from the idea of working in the theatre, which I think we spoke about before, working with Enda Walsh and Killian, and the idea that this boy is basically is performing a monologue on the stage. It's 3 hours in the life of a person. And I thought, well, actually, how much of that would need to be him? How much of that would necessarily need to be his own voice? Or could it be the voices of others? You know, how much to what extent are we created by the way other people see us? So I tried to create this sort of storm around him, which is the way other people conceive of him and his behavior, and then how he thinks of the mistakes he's made in the past. And then similarly, and with a kind of democratic balance, actually, the world of his nightmares and these sort of strange precognition glimpses of the future he has.
How much do you want to tell us about how his state of mind as we meet him in, by the way, I should say, the wonderfully named reform place that he is in called Last Chance, which is a little bit ominous for sure. How much do you want to tell me about how we find him and what his intentions are? And pretty clear to us, I think, as the novel begins.
Yeah, it's pretty clear, and I had an interesting time working out how clear I want that and how much I want the reader to draw their own conclusions about it. But the very first line of the book is that he's wearing a very heavy backpack full of rocks, and he's heading out into the night. So you make your own guesses about that. But what I did want to remove from it was the sense of a plan. I didn't want him to have a plan. I didn't want him to necessarily have left a note. I didn't want the dynamic in the book of a kind of trauma and effect. And therefore I didn't want him sort of deviating from a sort of expectation of the behavior of people that might be wanting to take their own lives or suffering from extraordinary emotional turbulence. So I wanted to sort of flood the whole thing with a kind of ambiguity that is the nighttime. You know, it's a nocturne, and he's as confused as we are at the beginning of the book as to where he's going and what he's going to do. And you know, my books all function a little bit like this, in as much as I want you, the reader, to have a completely bespoke reaction to this boy and where he's going. You know, you might judge him quite harshly. You know, some of the characters in the book thinks he should just do more exercise and, you know, or, you know, do his meditation tape or whatever. Other characters in the book have a great deal of sympathy for him. So, yeah, it's definitely a kind of collaborative undertaking with you, the reader, as to where he's going and what he might be doing.
Although I did pretty much pick up on one of the voices he hears at one point along the way that says, "Ding dong, here comes little Lord Mood Swing." Not a very sympathetic reaction to Shy's particular set of difficulties. Did you, in your head, Max, did you set out a series of events from the past that may have him in the state that he's in? Or, again, do you want to leave that very open to the reader to decide on that?
Yeah, what I definitely didn't want a single cause of his troubles. I don't buy it as a kind of diagnostic or therapeutic analysis of a person's unhappiness. But what I did want to do is kind of pattern his boyhood, pattern these terrible moments of violence from his recent past, his teenage misdemeanors. And then I'm a big editor. I wrote this book quite fast and I edited it very, very carefully for quite a long time. And then what I realized in the kind of, like, once I'd created the kind of fabric of the whole thing, I realized there were these moments when I needed more of the kind of pure, you know, drug-fueled mistake, or I needed more of boyhood tenderness, or I needed more of this kind of yearning to be involved in the social world of his peers. And then I went back through and sort of patterned it. So I hope it has a kind of living, breathing truth to it as regards a person's sense of themselves. You know, the way that if you suddenly remember something that mortifies you from your recent past, something you're ashamed of, there's that sudden kind of pulse-raising, hot, rushing, you know, almost shame as a physical symptom.
Yes.
And I wanted him to have these moments, you know, out there in the night while he's thinking about it.
Maybe you would read a section for us which will give us a sense of the nature of how the book works in terms of the voices coming in and out of Shai's head. I think you'll probably need to set this up a little bit for us.
Yeah, well, I'll give you a couple. I'll move from therapist to Shai. You very, very rarely hear from Shai himself. Everyone is cajoling, begging Shai to explain, to talk more. So I'll give you a little blast of him talking after his therapist. The disappointment gap again, Shai. Remember? Shai, we thought your sleep cave would help, and it didn't. So you're anxious and you're cross with yourself. And this is a loss-focused thinking style, right? Remember, Shai, are we listening? Okay, headphones off, please, Shai. That's just rude. Okay, look, I think this music isn't helping. It's so fast and choppy and metallic. I think if we're looking for reasons why you're not getting REM sleep, we might look no further than the Walkman, right? It's very on and we need you off. Shai, anyone home? I really did think we were getting past this sort of behaviour. Visions. Night terrors, voices, conversations on the phone with his mum about his psychic great-granny, conversations with Steve about William Blake and migraines and ayahuasca, conversations with the doctor about pills and avoiding weed and horror films, conversations with Jenny about fight and flight, fresh air and exercise, recognizing the itch behind his eyes, tired lines of thought, repetitions, uncanny hunches. It's like, he's trying to describe it, it's like a roll of barbed wire scrunched inside me, scraping underneath all day, every day, and then it gives way to something slippy, busy. Sometimes I feel really excited and bouncy, and other people's thoughts are all buzzing in my whole body like I can tell what they're feeling. Easy pictures, clear sequences, like I know exactly what's going on before and after. Like my brain's found its groove, then it's gone again. Just sludge.
That's Max Porter reading from his new novel, Shai, first of all in the therapist's voice and then in something approaching the voice of the leading character, Shai himself. I've remarked before to you, Max, on your ability to bring the writing off the page into a type of performance style, and certainly your therapist voice showing very fine acting talent once again on your part. Do you write with that kind of... Even as you spoke to me earlier in our chat this evening, I got the sense that almost the stage version or some kind of performed version of the novel was in your head even as you were writing it.
I mean, yes, but not literally. Like not that I think this should be turned into a play. I'm not sure that would work. But I want that energy in the text of the novel. And I don't see why the novel shouldn't have it. You know, I don't see why the novel should limit itself to one, you know, anything really, to one atmospheric environment or one sort of presentational style. I think if the novel can strip away to the point where you're listening to these people and they are performing in your head, you know, and I like to think that I slightly teach the reader how to read these books as they go, and that any sort of sense of being a bit lost at the beginning, think, oh God, who's talking now? You know, like that line you said, ding, ding, here comes a little Lord Mood Swing. I want the reader to be thinking at that stage, well, that's probably the stepdad. That's rather unsympathetic. That'll be the stepdad. And another reader might think, no, it's the teacher, and that's actually kind of affectionate. So it depends on how you read it in your head. you know, so you're the kind of director of this piece, and you can flood it with your own sensibilities, you know, as you said, whether it's sympathy with Shy or whether it's something more, more intolerant. And I like that, empowering the reader that way.
Yeah, so
I think that's one of the things that theatre does as well, isn't it? You know, if you're performing to a room of 500 people, you're basically performing 500 different plays. And I find that very interesting.
And the music, Shai, very fond of his music, but it's quite, it's a particular type of music, a particular type of energy within the music that he's listening to.
Yeah, the whole book clatters along at 170 beats per minute because he's obsessed with drum and bass. And I wanted to give him a real obsession. You know, I wanted to give him this access to a kind of ecstatic mode of feeling that is his love of this music. Yeah, in fact, when I come over to Ireland in a week or two to do the Corch Festival in Galway, we got a drum and bass DJ, so people can feel what Shy feels.
Yeah, and that sense of the drum and bass rhythm, because it is, I mean, as you say, it clatters along at quite a rate for the most part. Do you listen as you write, you know, or do you listen to a load of music and kind of have that as your, I suppose, your playlist as you're writing a book?
Yeah, I mean, this one, what I did, I tend to write to fairly minimal, you know, ambient music and no words, or like old church, you know, Renaissance church music and things. I like to have that kind of thing going on while I'm writing, while I'm concentrating. But then when I edited this book, as I say, it's quite a long process of editing it and trying various different orders and different juxtapositions within it to create different energies. That's when I had the drum and bass on, because, you know, the thing about the age of drum and bass now, 30 years old this year, really, the kind of the emergence of drum and bass in the UK, the big record labels. And so the convergence of that scene with the technology of YouTube means that there is an absolute array of really well done mixes by middle aged, I have to say, usually men, but not exclusively, who found all the old records and they've done incredible annotations. Yeah. So you can listen to hours and hours and hours of really well mixed jungle and drum and bass on YouTube. Should you want to spend your evening that way?
Should you choose to? Yeah. One final question that I wanted to talk to you a little bit about was, I know when we spoke about Lanny in particular, and we referred back to grief, is the thing with Feathers in this respect as well, how you kept yourself kind of slightly distant from the lead characters. We don't necessarily hear directly from them. We hear other people talking about them, or we hear about them through the voices of others. It struck me that in the case of Shai, you seem to be coming a little bit closer to actually putting words into the character's voice himself.
Yeah, that's really interesting that you would say that, and I'm kind of glad you feel that way. I felt that it would be a kind of that it would, because previously the centrifugal absence of the characters, you know, the mother in grief and Lanny has, has sort of embedded them, because their absence creates more work for you to do to think about who they are, and they become enigmatic in that way. But Shy, I wanted the enigma to be more deeply rooted, more of a battle zone. And, you know, more of the question of who is Shy and how, what to do about a person like Shy needs multiple Shys involved. It needs us to be suddenly appalled by him and then suddenly really quite sympathetic or tender towards him. And then, you know, perhaps I would employ something quite sentimental and ask you to think whether that instinct is alive in you towards him, and himself be quite repulsed by that. He doesn't accept help very gladly in this book. And so I think I needed him more closely modeled than I have with previous people. Yeah. So as to encourage that kind of stalking of him in the reader's mind.
Yes, certainly we do get that kind of more inside his head possibly than we did previously. Max, great to speak with you as always. Thanks for being with us this evening.
Thanks so much. Take care.
You too. That's Max Porter. And Max's new novel, Shy, is published by Faber. And as he's told you there, Max will be at the Corch Festival in Galway. He's at the Town Hall Theatre, in fact, in the City of the Tribes at 8:30 p.m. on Friday, the 21st of April. And you can find out full details on corch.ie. Mr. William Shakespeare's Comedies, Histories and Tragedies is a collection of plays by, of course, William Shakespeare. It is commonly referred to as the First Folio by modern scholars. It was published in 1623, 7 years after Shakespeare's death, and is considered to be one of the most influential books ever published. There is just one copy of the first folio on the island of Ireland. And later this month, it will go on public display in Trinity College as part of the global celebrations to mark the 400th anniversary of the publication. And it will be the centrepiece of an exhibition entitled Shakespeare, the Irish Man, which opens in Trinity's Old Library on April the 13th. What a date to pick to open it. Lucky for some, it would seem. To tell me more about the first folio and the exhibition, I'm joined by the curator and professor of English at Trinity, Andy Murphy. First of all, Andy, maybe give us a sense of, tell us exactly what we're talking about when we talk about that first folio and just why it's so important.
Sure. So you mentioned there, Sean, that Shakespeare died in 1616. At the point when he died, only about half of his plays had been published. So we could potentially have lost the other half. We could have lost Antony and Cleopatra. We could have lost Julius Caesar. We could have lost Macbeth and a number of other plays. But a couple of years after Shakespeare died, his colleagues in the theatre company, the King's Men Theatre Company, got together with one of the main publishers in London, and they drew together all of the plays and produced this volume called the First Folio. It's called the First Folio because it was in the folio size. That was the biggest size book you could publish at the
and
time.
And what kind of size are we talking about in those terms?
Oh, about, well, roughly speaking, about if you put three paperbacks, modern paperbacks, side by side, you'd roughly get about the size of the volume. So it was a big book, about 900 pages in double columns, 36 plays.
And there would not, had this not been published, we wouldn't be talking about comedies, histories and tragedies. Would we be talking about more, would we be talking more about one or other of those particular genres?
We'd certainly be talking about histories, because histories were the most popular plays, really, in the kind of end of the 1500s into the early 1600s. And Shakespeare's histories had been published again and again in different editions. But it's really the later work that we would have lost. So, for example, we would have lost The Tempest, which is probably the last play that Shakespeare wrote as a solo writer.
Yeah.
And, you know, we think of that play oftentimes as being his farewell to the theatre. So, again, that would have been lost to us had it not been for the folio.
Of course, even when we say, or as you said there, the last play that Shakespeare wrote, this in and of itself is a possibly a contentious idea. What would Shakespeare have given to the actors of his day? He wouldn't have come in the morning and said, lads, I've written this play, here's a copy of it for all of you, off you go. That's not at all how he wrote.
Yes, I mean, we certainly know that actors were given roles, and they were literal roles, you know, so we talk about it, the role of an actor, but of course these were rolls of paper that would have had their bits on them with their cue lines and that sort of thing.
So it would essentially, you'd be given your role, as in your sheet, your roll of paper, and therein would be your half a dozen speeches.
Yes.
And just the cue line and the character that would be possibly just the cue line into them.
Yes, probably just that. So, you know, it would have been quite a different process from the process that we see in modern theatre, for sure.
And in those terms, then, how much do we know of when Shakespeare would put on a play? So he'd hand you your role, he'd hand me my role. Would it play for a night or two, and he'd say, "Do you know what? I need to add a little bit here, and I need to give Andy a few more speeches, and I need to get John to say less."
Well, we know that runs were very short in Shakespeare's time, and Shakespeare's theatre company was very much a repertory theatre company. So plays went on for short runs, they were replaced by something else, and then the plays came back again. So we certainly know there was a kind of repertory structure there. In terms of whether Shakespeare revised, he may well have done, you know. So we do have, in the case of King Lear, we've got two rather different versions of that
of the play,
you know. And there's been controversy over, you know, is that because Shakespeare revised it? Is it because the theatre company revised it? Is it because the actors had input? We just don't know the answers to those questions.
But and I suppose the other part of what is possibly in the folios, because as you say, the first folio is after Shakespeare's death, what would be called the prompt book, which would be the book that the stage manager had compiled from all of the different roles that the characters had. That was what essentially became the published play.
It could be in some cases, you know, so we think there probably was a theatrical script. We know that in some cases what we may be looking at behind the published play is what Shakespeare actually wrote as his rough draft, for example. And in the case of some plays, we know that the theatre company, in preparation for publication, brought in a professional scribe, a guy called Ralph Crane, and he copied out a nice, clean copy of the play.
Of what actually was performed on the stage.
Exactly.
So it was a record of performance rather than, in many cases, what we got was a record of something that had happened rather than a planned performance from Shakespeare himself. What I'm trying to get at here is, how much, when we say Shakespeare wrote this play, how much we're depending on the actual performance for what he wrote?
Well, I mean, plays are never static objects. You know, they are always revised as they go along. And of course, we still revise Shakespeare to this day. You know, if you go and see a performance of Shakespeare, you're almost never seeing every single word that appears on the play as it is in the bookshop, you know, so directors will always cut, actors will always change.
So how many, there's only one copy of the First Folio in Ireland. Mm-hmm. How many copies of that book exist?
We think about 750 were printed initially in 1623. Mm. A bit over 230 still exist, which is actually quite good.
Quite a lot,
It means it's not in the strict sense a rare book. The vast majority of copies are in the US, but as you say, Sean, we have the only Irish copy we're lucky to have.
And how did you manage to get your hands on the only Irish copy?
Well, college bought it in 1805 for the princely sum of £26.11, if anybody remembers pre-decimal currency, which was quite a good price at the time. I mean, it was a lot of money at the time, but it was a competitive price at the time. College bought it after the death of somebody who had been a professor at Trinity, a guy called Arthur Brown. He died in 1805. His family were Irish, but he himself was born in Newport, Rhode Island. And he came back to Ireland at the age of 16 to become a student at Trinity and settled in Dublin and made a life for himself here.
Right, so £26.11 and 6 pence, which translates into what in terms of value in 2023?
I'm afraid you'd have to ask an economist that question.
What I mean is, how much is the folio worth now?
Oh, gosh. I mean, it, you know, the prices vary considerably depending on condition and that. But they go for a lot of money. They certainly for a lot of money.
Are we talking hundreds of thousands or are we talking millions? Of, you know, how high into the...
We're probably talking at the higher end of that, yeah.
Yeah, so it's quite a valuable book now. So the exhibition then, Shakespeare, the Irishman. Mm. What aspect of Shakespeare are we going to find his Irishness?
So we, you know, one of our ideas was we wanted to put the book on display so that people could see it. We wanted to celebrate the 400th anniversary. But then we started thinking that we wanted to focus on Irish dimensions in relation to Shakespeare as well. So also in the exhibition, we have the first editions of Shakespeare that were printed here in Dublin in the 18th century. And we also think a little bit about Shakespeare in relation to Irish politics. So, I mean, I guess we often tend to think of Shakespeare as very British or very English, but in fact, a lot of Irish nationalists were very interested in Shakespeare as well and very influenced by him. Patrick Pearse is a very good example. He was kind of obsessed with Shakespeare, really. And if you go to the Pearse Museum out in Rathfarnham and go to his study, you'll see there's a bust of Shakespeare there, and he had lots of additions as well.
And this despite the fact that the first Irishman can be handed over to Shakespeare and Henry V, isn't it? Yeah, and not a very flattering view of the Irish that we get there.
No, not a flattering portrait, the character Captain MacMorris in Henry V. But again, what's interesting about that is he appears in a scene where we also find a Welsh character and a Scottish character and an English character. And it seems to me what Shakespeare is doing there is he's trying to think about the idea of national identity and national identity within these islands. And do we constitute a community collectively or not? And of course, you know, that's a question we still think about in many ways today.
All right. So the book will be on display, or the folio will be on display, and there are a number of associated lectures and a big symposium as well in and around the work of Shakespeare. That's what the plan.
That's the plan.
Well, hope it goes well for you, Andy, and thanks for coming in to tell us about it. Andy Murphy there, Professor of English at Trinity College Dublin, curator of a new exhibition called Shakespeare the Irishman. It opens in the Old Library in Trinity College on April the 13th, along with an online exhibition that will also go live on that night. tcd.ie/library will give you all of the details. Andy's own lecture takes place on April the 12th, a public symposium then on April the 14th. Details there, tcd.ie/Trinity Long Room Hub. Beef is a new black comedy drama coming to Netflix. It sees two brittle people finally snap as they try to leave a Los Angeles car park when struggling handyman Danny almost reverses his truck into the car behind. He's met with beeping and a middle finger belonging to a tightly wound entrepreneur called Amy. Over 10 episodes, the mutually destructive feud escalates from pranking to attacks on property, careers and personal relationships, causing considerable collateral damage along the way. It stars Ali Wong and Steve Yeun. Let's listen to a clip that features Ali Wong coming home after the road rage incident that starts the whole series off. And here she is telling her husband, George, played by Joseph Lee, exactly what happened.
Well, then what's going on? You seem all riled up. Babe, come on. Talk to me.
Okay, well, you know, after the meeting, I was sitting in the parking lot thinking about how many meetings and calls I've had to do for the last 2 years. Still, somehow, there's no offer coming, and it just really got to me, you know? So then I started driving, and then there was this guy who...
Before you spiral, I'm gonna have you stop right there. Take a deep breath. Pause. You gotta start focusing on the positive, okay? You know, maybe we should start doing the gratitude journals again.
A little artist. Gratitude journals. Yeah, you're right. Let's do it. Thanks, babe.
She's a very patient woman. That's Ali Wong in the character of Amy there, talking to her husband, George, played by Joseph Lee in the very first episode of the new Netflix series, Beef. Jen Gannon has been watching it for us and she's with me in studio now. I have to say, Jen, I saw the beginning of this today. The opening sequence, the kind of the initial road rage, it's the adrenaline that's there, the nervousness that you had, that I had certainly watching it. It really is a pumped up series from the outset.
It really is. It's very anxiety laden. So, I mean, the whole premise of it sounds like an episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm, but it's not. It could be played for that. It could be played as a broad comedy with these, you know, separate people from two different walks of economic life trying to get their revenge on each other and playing these cat and mouse games of revenge against each other because of this road rage incident. But it actually, over the course of the 10 episodes, it opens out into something completely different and a lot more in depth and involved.
Yeah, but give us a sense of just how different their backgrounds are.
So Ali Wong plays Amy Lau. She is this plant entrepreneur, which sounds hilarious. She has a plant shop. She's almost like the Gwyneth Paltrow of plants, if you can imagine. And she's kind of like an influencer. And then Danny, who's played by Steven Yeun, he's this enterprising contractor slash handyman. And they're polar opposites in that way, but they actually are the same side of the coin when it comes to the fact that they are both living on their nerves, living on the edge. I mean, it's not exactly Michael Douglas falling down kind of end of things, but it's almost there. There's it's seeds. There's a boiling frustration to the show that explodes off the screen at points. And it's such a visceral watch. And it's about, you know, modern living. And it's really a meditation on modern life, as in how these things escalate, how we're all kind of walking around with our own issues and our own problems. And when we collide against each other, when we rub up against each other, it can be like an explosion, like a tinderbox. It can just spill out. And, you know, it's all about that. It's all about how these two people just find each other, but also they kind of enjoy the fact that they're allowed to, you know, especially for Ali Wong's character, because she has to paint this grin on her face every day.
Well, let's face it, her husband just said to her, don't you think it's time to start the gratitude journals, honey? Now, how she didn't get road rage when he says that is kind of beyond me.
And he is the most zen person in this. And
yeah,
he can
but zen
be,
people can...
He can be the most zen person because he comes from a very privileged background. He's from the art world and his parents are artists and she's the main breadwinner. So when he has grown up in this life of luxury, she feels like she's the one that has to provide and keep them in this lifestyle that they're accustomed to. But she's a coiled spring of a woman just waiting to explode. And, you know, Danny, Stephen Yeun, gives her that opportunity to do that in her life.
Yeah, because sometimes the zen can be the very thing that drives you over the edge. It's inevitable that they're going to have to meet and that they're going to have to interact in some way, the Danny character, the Stephen Yeun, and Ali Wong's Amy. So he has found out her address. And here he is coming up to the door to pretend. I'm a local handyman, sure. Yeah, any job you need done.
Sorry to bother you. I'm a contractor working down the street. Did you remodel recently?
Yeah. Why?
Well, I couldn't help but notice that your rooftop conduits don't have supports. It's an electrical hazard.
What?
I'm not trying to make any money off of you. I just thought I'd come and let you know so you can get your guy to fix it.
Hey, you're not some kind of weirdo, right? Because if you are, you should know that I own a gun.
Like I said, miss, I'm just trying to be helpful. Didn't mean to make you uncomfortable. I'll be on my way.
Hey, no, just wait a second. Okay, I'll be right there.
Hi.
Hi.
I don't know how they manage. That's Steve Yeun and Amy Lau as the Ali Wong, I beg your pardon, as Amy Lau, and the other one, Steve Yeun, as the character of Danny. Even in that scene, Jen Gannon, you know, you get the tension, even though this is, it's a very simple interaction between the two of them. You think anything could blow up in front of both of them at any moment.
Mm, and they want to play these tactics because then it becomes
cat and mouse.
At the beginning,
type of thing,
it is like a cat and mouse, as in he goes into the bathroom then and destroys her bathroom. And then she decides to get him back by giving all these really bad Yelp reviews of his handyman business. But but to be honest, as it continues on, it's not really about that. It's not about those pettiness. It's about these people's lives.
It's about modern society,
yeah,
isn't it?
And why they're like this and what happens to you when, you know, Danny feels very spat out by life. He has, you know, he is from an immigrant family from Korea. He wants to move his parents over. He feels a lot of shame and embarrassment about the way his life has turned out. He's not married. He lives with his younger brother, who's very childish. And he doesn't feel like he's achieved the American dream. And he resents Ali Wong's character, Amy. He looks at her life and her, you know, luxurious surroundings. Yeah. And he really wants to enact this horrible revenge on her. And she feels the same about him. She feels like he's a lowlife. He's nothing to offer. But he's more of just a reflection of the anxiousness and anxieties of her life as well.
And Ali Wong, obviously known for her stand-up comedy, is this a totally new departure for her, and how well is she doing?
It's a great performance by her, I have to say. It's totally different from anything we've ever seen her do. We know her stand-up, we know her from Always Be My Maybe, the rom-com, but this is very different. It's, you know, an arduous task to actually make these people fully rounded characters, but they both do it so well. I mean, Stephen Yeun, as we know, he's such a great actor in something like Burning, and he imbues Danny with this multifaceted personality where you can see his flaws. He's not a hero, but he's not a complete loser either. He's very sensitive and fragile, but he also does terrible things, as we see later on as it progresses.
Does it work, and are you recommending Beef?
I am. I think, like, you know, the 10 episode structure, it seems long, but it's
necessary.
They're
only about 35 minutes, are they?
Yeah, they're
half
40
an hour.
Minutes around. 40, and it's necessary because it's a sprawling, very complex show, and I think we need the time with these characters to understand their motivations, to understand why they are the way they are. And I think it works so well. And I will be absolutely astonished if it's not Emmy nominated for both of them. And I think they roundly deserve it.
And they're the centre. They're the centre.
They
of
are
it, really.
The centre.
All right. That sounds good for sure. That's Beef on Netflix from tomorrow. Jen Gannon previewing it for us. And that is our lot for this Tuesday evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Michelle Gibson was the broadcast coordinator. Jimmy and Chanel was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by
Reg Luby. I will talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, once again here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.